es considered everyone. The last case of the day is case number 60775, Peak Development versus RB Properties. I'm sitting in place of Justice Gibbons, who recused himself voluntarily due to a conflict. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. McNutt?
I am, Madam Justice.
And how much time would you like to reserve?
3 minutes.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Ms. Chief Justice, Justice Douglas, Justice Sada. May it please the Court. Dan McNutt, on behalf of the appellants, Peak Development and Sierra Associated Investments. The covenant of issues here today to build a street on a conveyed easement is a classic example of a covenant that runs with the land. Those are not my words. I like those words. I agree with those words. Those are the words of the Chief Justice of the Nevada Supreme Court in 1963. Chief Justice Bat, in the case City of Reno versus Magna. And in that case, the court held that the easement at issue was a permit, ran with the land in perpetuity, and was enforceable and binding on its successors in interest. Today, I'm asking the court, on behalf of appellants, to also conclude, like the Magna court, that the easement at issue here is a pertinent, attaches to the land, and is binding on all successors in interest. My request is that this court overturn the summary judgment order of the district court judge and follow the overwhelming weight of authority that suggests this easement, this three-page document at the heart of this case, is in fact a pertinent. It is neither void ab initio, nor is it any worse. As the starting point to that analysis, the restatement of property third in 2000 tells us that easements of pertinent are the presumed state of the law. And respondents acknowledge that in their brief. And some courts, some states, like Colorado, Montana, and Washington, they go a step further and say, actually, the default presumption is that the default rule is, in fact, that easements are appropriate because they benefit the land. As we go further in our interpretation, we know from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in 2001, SOC versus Mirage, that we interpret an easement document much like we interpret a contract. So the initial starting point for this case is the document itself. And the record is replete with the analysis of this document. On its face, this document tells us that it is a perpetual easement. It's a small, sublime group that's made in bold, all-cap font on the top of the page. This document tells us that there are seven parcels to which this pertinent easement attaches. This document tells us that there's a specific meets and bounds description for precisely where this easement should run along those seven parcels. And most importantly, this document tells us the express purpose of this easement. This easement is for the purpose of providing an 80-foot wide roadway, underground utilities, gas lines, sewer lines, and the like, and drainage on this 80-foot wide easement. And it doesn't stop there. In protection of the easement rights, this document grants the right to clear and keep clear any obstruction from the surface or subsurface that would interfere with these rights. Now, few things say that they attach themselves to the land so dramatically as 80 feet of concrete asphalt, underground utility lines, and drainage pipe. In fact, I would submit if something is buried in the ground under this easement, it has done just about everything it can do to attach itself to the land and inherit itself to the property.
What do you make of your opposing colleague's argument, and I'm not sure it was made in the district court, that RB Properties for the piece of the easement on parcel 2 was in essence granting an easement to itself on land it owned and therefore was void ab initio under a variant of the merger doctrine, which I guess would work out that the Sierra property in 7 that's a successor to the South Point property would have granted an easement across its land, but not as to the RB piece.
Thank you, Chief Justice. That is their argument. They've shifted back and forth throughout the various pleadings in the underlying case, and there's been a little bit of shifting now that we're in front of this court. Simply stated, they can't decide whether they would like to have the merger in total or the fact that they would have this cheaper variant of merger for partial merger. They just know that they don't want what they've created, which in fact is an easement appointment. But there is a direct reading.
But let's say it's an easement appointment. Say we conclude with you that that's the case. What do you do with the merger doctrine?
Then this court could look at that easement, and on the 4 properties to the north that were owned by Peak, originally by RB Properties, that would be the 001 parcel, the 002 parcel, the original 007 parcel, and the 003 parcel. The court, a fair reading, the court could apply merger to those 4 parcels, but it would have to keep the appurtenant easement running south. Because again, this document says that RB Properties is the grantee. So RB Properties would still get its easement going south to Casino Drive across the 3 parcels owned by South Point Properties.
Which would be 4 and 5.
Which would be 4, 5, and then there's a second 002 parcel, and it's denoted 810-002.
Okay. So do you concede then that it's not a valid easement over 1, 2, and 3, and 7?
If the court desires to apply the doctrine of merger in that context, I wouldn't argue with them. There's a fair reading that it could be.
Tell me why that's a wrong reading.
Well, if the court is going to say that that way, it's not a wrong reading, provided that they follow through and say the easement is appurtenant going south to Casino Drive. But if the court simply agreeing with the thesis of respondents that they can pick and choose how they want to apply, quote, partial merger, because their version of partial merger, Chief Justice, was they wanted to apply partial merger to the north for RB and then partial merger again to the south for South Point Properties. And that is not a fair reading whatsoever with the document, because again, RB Properties has to have be granted that easement to go south, because
right.
The document says.
So, RB Properties granted South Point an easement.
Or that's in reverse. RB and South Point granted,
yes.
RB Properties is the grantee.
Yes, exactly so.
Under the way you've articulated it, I would concur. Under their version of, we get partial merger going to the north to get rid of it, and partial merger to the south, which equals whole merger, and that's how they got to void ab initio.
Right.
That was the pathway that they went. So on your analysis, I would concur, on the respondents, not quite so much. Outside the confines of this document, if the court desires to entertain extrinsic evidence that's in the record, respondents say, we don't actually need to look at this document. That, by the way, was drafted by Mr. Gobray, the president of RB Properties, the president of South Point Properties. Mr. Gobray is a lawyer, longstanding. I believe he's on an active status, but he is a lawyer. And they say, we should just ask Mr. Gobray what his intent was. That's what we should do. And so they ask Mr. Gobray what his intent. Well, shockingly, Mr. Gobray's intent now, that he's lost a couple of parcels through foreclosure, is that there is no desire to have an easement on this land. Ironically, Mr. Gobray, on page 84 of his deposition, said, quote, in answer to a question, the document speaks for itself, which I believe this easement was exhibit 3 of his deposition. That was not an objection by his lawyer. That was his comment. The document speaks for itself. Fair enough. So everything that the respondents put in their brief about what his intent would be, by his own words, is codified in this document as we look at it. However, the other extrinsic evidence that is powerful and unbiased from third parties, I think, does merit the court's consideration. Jeffrey Warren, is the proverbial guy that has no dog in this fight. He was not a party. He was merely the manager of mapping and surveying for Clark County. He deals with easements, surveys, and developer maps every day. His assistant, Julie Wonder. They both were opposed. They both said that there's no way that this easement could be relinquished unless every party that had an interest in the easement relinquished their rights. Those parties being Peak Development, those parties being Appellants. Another third party that actually had something to protect and just told the truth and went against her own self-interest would have been Bonnie Blackburn. Ms. Blackburn was the title officer at Chicago Title. Now, if the court will recall on the record, in or around 2005, RB Properties sold the 001 parcel to an entity called H&R Acquisition. H&R Acquisition, prior to closing, Chicago Title, prior to closing, required Mr. Goldberg and RB Properties to execute a relinquishment of his easement rights. Were this merely an ingress easement that terminates when the personal right is no longer in existence, either by death of the grantee or conveyance, there would be no reason to have that partial relinquishment executed at the time of the closing. Additionally, when asked and pressed, would you have done this differently? Yes, this is what Ms. Blackman said. It was a mistake to not get the relinquishments of Peak Development and CR Associated Investments. That's what she said. That was, and her counsel is on the record with an objection, but then said that she could answer. If I had to do it differently today, I would have said there's only a partial relinquishment of this easement in the title report.
Those three people. Did the relinquishment purport to release the easement rights going across the South Point properties as well?
Chief Justice, if I could, on page 3 of the opening brief is a map. And it's this map that
I have that, yeah.
If I have it right there.
Yeah, it was upside down.
So, what's in black, that is the westerly 40 feet of the easement, because the easement, the center line of the easement runs down the property line. So it's 80 feet wide. The westerly 40 feet is what they relinquished. Meaning that partial relinquishment. Everything in green has remained or should remain. If I may take one more minute, and I'll reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The way they've articulated merger is simply inappropriate. Merger is a simple and useful doctrine that should be applied when appropriate. And I don't disagree with the Chief Justice's comment about how you would apply it in this case, provided that that easement appropriate stays in place going south and the Peak Development itself. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ken Lund on behalf of RB Properties and South Point Properties. Listening to appellant's argument, there's a few issues that need to be clarified, so I want to jump directly to the merger issue. In district court, in our motion for summary judgment, and in defending this appeal, we have made the same argument consistently the entire time with respect to the merger doctrine. We have always argued partial merger, and the significance of partial merger, and appellants have now conceded for the first time at any time in these proceedings that the easement is extinguished as to the four parcels where RB Properties granted to RB Properties the easement over RB Properties parcels. So these are
apart from the concession, what do you make of the argument? And I'm not sure it was an unqualified concession, that's why I'm pressing the point. What do you make of the argument that South Point and RB Properties were separate owners of separate pieces, and you had an easement grant? Let's leave aside the tax sale business for a minute. Where, I mean, it's one reading of this easement could be that it was reciprocal, that South Point was granting RB Properties an easement and vice versa.
Well,
why is that not a reasonable reading of this?
Certainly, Your Honor. There's several questions of that. Let me start.
Yes, there are.
In Nevada, under SOC, we give strict construction to the words of an instrument. In this instrument, there's no reading that will allow a plaintiff to infer that this was a reciprocal easement. The plain language of the easement states that RV properties and South Point properties as grantors conveyed to RV properties as grantee the easement. So any argument, and this is what plaintiff is making.
And it's assigned.
And it's assigned. However, South Point property is not an assign.
Right.
Of RV properties. It conceivably could be, but as for the document, South Point properties cannot be construed as a grantee. So this is not a reciprocal easement. This is to RV properties in RV only. Where there's ambiguity and why we're here today is, was that RV properties in gross, or did the benefits run with the land? Were they a permanent?
Do you agree that at minimum, Mr. McNutt's clients have an easement running south over the South Point properties to Casino Drive?
Now here's where it gets tricky, Your Honor. That issue has not been preserved. In the district court, our argument was partial merger. And remember, the dispute in this case arose out of our client's relinquishment of the portion of the easement that burdened Mariner's View, or H&R originally, but then it was eventually conveyed to Mariner's View. This dispute,
which is the parcel one piece, right?
Exactly. And, well, it's parcel one. And Peak, so the relinquishment happened. And it's telling that Mariner's View went to RV properties. It didn't go to all of the parcel owners that were affected by the easement. It went to RV properties and RV properties only. And the relinquishment occurs.
And why is South Point Properties a party to this?
Well, South Point Properties is, I don't know, they sued South Point.
Don't you represent them?
One of the grantors.
You represent, yes, okay.
But going back to your question about whether the easement burdens, whether the easement was extinguished by merger all over the South Point parcels, that issue has never been preserved, and here's why. We have never argued that the doctrine of merger in total. And admittedly, there's vagueness in the district court order about whether the entire easement is extinguished or whether the easement over the four parcels is extinguished. In appellant's briefing, all they've done is attack the application of partial merger. And I don't see where they draw a distinction. I really don't see how they can read from our briefing and from our arguments in the underlying court that we've ever argued total merger.
Let's assume it was preserved. What's your position with respect to Peak and Sierra's easement rights across parcels 4 and 5 and maybe 11 and 3.
Assuming that it's been preserved, the problem that's created, and once again, because it hasn't been preserved, this issue hasn't been briefed.
But you would agree that they do have an easement, for your partial merger argument, you agree that they have an easement across the bottom 4 parcels to Casino Drive?
The authorities that we've cited would say yes, that the merger would only apply over the 4 parcels. However, the consequence of the extinguishment over the northern 4 parcels is important because there's consequences that go along with that. Plaintiff has argued in their briefing, and there's authority throughout the nation, that is never ruled on the issue, however, that an appurtenant easement to be valid has to terminate at the dominant estate. If the 4 parcels over RV are extinguished, then Peak and Mariner's View's parcels, 01 and 02, they're cut off from the portion of the easement that is still in effect. The Sierra parcel and the RV properties parcel, that's 3 and it's 7 in some documents and 11 in the other, this is an 80-foot wide easement, but they would only have a 40-foot connection to the portion of the easement that is in effect, and they couldn't get any wider because of where their property boundaries lie. That creates complications that could extinguish the remainder of the easement. However, plaintiff has never challenged the scope of the district court's order. Or he ordered that
the district court's order pretty much says this easement's engrossed, and therefore I'm going to accept the relinquishment or rescission or whatever it was called. And that seems to me to be the driving force. If you say it's a pertinent, then all these other arguments come into play, right?
Exactly, Your Honor.
If it's engrossed, it's the end of it.
If you rule that this easement is engrossed under the circumstances, the other issues are moot.
But let's say the district court is wrong. We conclude that it's a pertinent. Then wouldn't all these other issues be in play, and it would be maybe appropriate to reverse and demand for determination?
My argument would be that plaintiff has waived their right to argue or contest the scope of the district court's order on whether the South Point parcels are still covered by the merger. All they've argued, they put all their eggs in the basket, that there's just no merger, period. This is the first time today where they've conceded that it's extinguished at least to those four parcels. That said, the second argument, if you're looking just at the merger issue, I would concede that under the case law, partial merger would affect the four northern parcels. However, then there's the term.
I think their point is you're arguing merger, and they're arguing no, but if there is merger, it's at best partial merger. Am I misunderstanding?
We've argued partial merger consistently.
Did you argue complete merger?
Well, what plaintiff has argued throughout, and if you look at your briefing, as you see in the briefing, they're saying that they're arguing that because the three of the parcels were owned by South Point, that there is not even partial merger. That's what they've argued the entire time.
So they're saying there's no merger at all because you have two different people owning it, and it's sort of like a reciprocal easement.
Exactly. The cases that they've cited, if there's a fractional interest, then there's no merger. But the cases that have been cited both by them and by us, if just because not all seven parcels were owned by RB doesn't mean there's merger over RB's parcels. But this court doesn't have to reach that issue because this easement is engrossed. All of the terms in the easement that plaintiffs say clearly show that this is an emergent easement are just as applicable to an engrossed easement. Plaintiff's argument is like a Venn diagram where you have a circle where the attributes that are exclusively pertinent and the attributes that are exclusively engrossed. But where plaintiff and the law differ is that under the law, there's significant intersection. The fact that this is perpetual does not mean that this is an engrossed easement. RB Properties is a corporation. They're potentially perpetual. Moreover, he argued just now that the fact that we think that the easement continued to be in existence after the conveyance, after Bill Gray lost the properties in the tax sale, that it's extinguished. Well, our position is that it's an engrossed easement and RB Properties continues to have a right to that easement. So the fact that they relinquished to Mariner's View, that actually supports our position.
What do you say with respect to section 4.5 of the restatement third that seems, as I read it, says you presume that an easement is impertinent?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not impertinent, a pertinent.
In their briefing.
You would not have us accept that, or you see that 4.5 differently?
They omit a critical portion of 4.5.
Okay. What is it that they omit?
Because 4.5 says, unless the factors set forth in section 4.1 say differently, then those default positions apply. And I am happy to call them default or presumptions. There's no question that appurtenant easements are preferred. But Nevada law seeks to ascertain the intent of the parties. If you can do it through the language of the easement itself, that's the preferred way. But in this case, this easement could just as reasonably be construed to be an engrossed easement as it could be an appurtenant easement. So then, what 4.1 says is you look at the surrounding circumstances. In this case is unique, but there's nothing untoward about it. Yes, my client is the president of South Point and RV Properties, both the grantor and the grantee, and he testified incredibly in their brief. They deny this. They say that Mr. Bilbray has never testified that it's engross. It's plainly in his deposition. He's the grantor and the grantee. There's no dispute between the two.
But that's his subjective intention. I mean, if you allow people to say, I signed this letter giving you X, but I really secretly meant Y, you know, that kind of testimony is usually kept out on the parallel evidence rule. Why wouldn't it be here kept out? It's a subjective intent as I understand it.
Understood, Your Honor. And if the language between the four corners of the document, if
it's not ambiguous, you look at the document.
If it's not ambiguous and it's pertinent, then you read it as such, and any of the parallel evidence isn't material. But in this case, it is ambiguous. He says...
How is the language ambiguous? It may be inconclusive, but how is it ambiguous?
Because it's two RV properties.
It's RV to RV as a source of ambiguity.
RV and South Point to RV, that's correct. Now, what plaintiff has been arguing throughout is that because it's recorded against seven parcels, that those are the parcels that are benefited. There is nowhere in the document where it states what parcels are benefited by the document. Now, plaintiff says because it says perpetual, because of the nature of the use for roadway utilities, drainage, and because it uses the term as assigns, he draws from that the conclusion that this must be an appurtenant easement, but that's not necessarily the case. And we've cited a number of cases that show assignability is an attribute of both engross and appurtenant. Perpetualness is an attribute of both appurtenant and engross easements. In fact, they cite cases where the court found that it was engross and it had the same language. Our client has the right to create for himself a roadway for his personal use. Now, in the surrounding circumstances...
Well, but if RB sells all its property and South Point still holds its property, wouldn't it be a very meaningless roadway across South Point's property? It would just be sort of to build a roadway?
Well, RB Properties has the right to use that roadway for their commercial purposes. And that's where the surrounding circumstances become so important. Because the document is ambiguous, whether it's engross or pertinent, and so we immediately go to the surrounding circumstances. And then you look at what's happened in this case. My client conveyed this parcel 6 days before a tax sale. He didn't convey it to both RV and South Point, it was just to RV. Why would he convey an appurtenant easement burdening other properties that he still owned when he knew that those parcels were going to go to somebody else 6 days later? There's a lot of reasons to question the nature of this instrument. Then you go to the surrounding circumstances, and you have the testimony of the grantor and the grantee that say, this is an engross easement. When Mariners View asked for conveyance, they went to Mariners View. This is an engross easement, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You still have 2 minutes and 19 seconds.
I cannot be saying it's the first time up here. As George Washington said at the end of the Revolution, he was addressing the troops, he said, I've been grown old and gray in the service of my country, but never blind as well.
That would be the three of us.
I feel the same way. Let me answer a couple of questions. We did not concede the doctrine of merger. And let me go directly to what was the district court's order. I will read from page 3. This is in the conclusions of law.
What's your record side on it?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Keep going.
Thus, by operation of law, the subject easement was void ab initio under the doctrine of merger. Under the doctrine of partial merger, under the doctrine of merger. That's the order that was signed by Judge Williams on July 10th, 2009. What we took issue with, because we had the view that the Chief Justice has, that this was a reciprocal easement for RB Properties, South Point Properties, going both ways. If you look at this document itself, and again, that is the start starting point and ending point of the analysis. This is an 80-foot wide easement for underground gas lines, underground utility lines, underground drainage and sewer lines. 80 feet of asphalt and curb and gutter. It's going to impact seven parcels of land that are all designed for commercial development, which is approximately 150 acres. Now, that's a thoroughfare. 80-foot wide road, it's not a cow path. This does not speak to an easement in gross for personal use of RV properties or some individual. And all of these things that they take issue with in this easement document, they say, these can be indicia that it's an easement in gross. Yes, they can, but they're always indicative that it's an easement of pertinent. So yes, they can go find a case from some jurisdiction in Massachusetts, like the Chuba case, or the Schlegel case in Washington, and say, oh, well, we can distinguish that. But when that document is taken in its totality, the easement document, and all of those things that we've articulated in our briefs today, every single one of those points to the conclusion that this is an easement appurtenant, it's attached itself to the land, and it is inherent in the property, and is binding on all successors and interests, which in this case is Peak Development and Sierra Associates.
Thank you very much. Both of you, thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs. This is a hard case, and it was very helpful.
Thank you.
We'll stand in recess in the case of the submission.